When I was in second grade, I committed a small minor infraction in the classroom, and the teacher said, "Mr. Ray, you will go to the principal's office right now." And my little heart started beating as fast as it had ever beat before, because I knew what awaited me in the principal's office. See, I grew up in the old days, and he had a big old wooden paddle, and you could hear the paddling that took place in there, so I knew what was coming. But as I was walking out the door, headed to the principal's office, one of the kids sitting right near the door said, "Ooh, you're in trouble." And something about that was almost as bad as what I knew was coming. "Ooh, you're in trouble." And then as we got older, whenever someone would get in trouble, we would say, "Ooh, busted," right? Busted. Do they still do that? "Ooh, busted," or "Ooh, you're in trouble." The dictionary defines the word trouble as to agitate mentally or spiritually, to worry or to disturb. How many of you have had trouble this week? How many of you have been mentally or spiritually agitated or disturbed? A lot of you. How many of you are in trouble right now? Well, I want to share with you a story, a well-known story from the Old Testament about trouble. And what our beliefs about God have to do with our times of trouble. And whether we serve a small God or a medium-sized God or a great big God makes a big difference when we're in trouble. The story takes place in the land of Israel. The Israelites were in a lot of trouble, and the name of their trouble is the Midianites. The Midianites were a tribe of people who lived in that area. They had attacked the Israelites. They had overtaken their land. And even though the Israelites were living in the promised land, it felt like a land full of trouble. The Bible says that the Midianites were like swarms of locusts all over the land. They just ravaged the land. They took it over. They took the homes, they took the crops from the Israelites. In fact, it was so bad that the Israelites were living in caves and holes in the ground. They had nothing to eat. Their land was stripped bare. They were literally at the point of starvation. And as we often do when we get to that point in our trouble where it's so bad that we don't know what else to do, we turn to God. And that's what they did. The Israelites, they cried out to God, "Lord, we're in big trouble, save us." And God sent the Israelites help. He sent them rescue in the form of a very unlikely person. This guy's name was Gideon. And here's the story of Gideon. The story of Gideon begins in Judges 6, verse 11. And it says in Judges 6, verse 11, says, "The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak tree in Ophrah that belonged to Joash, the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites." Now, something that you don't notice right away just when you hear or read that verse is that Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press. Now, it's called a wine press because you make wine in it, not thresh wheat in it. If you're going to thresh wheat, you would thresh wheat on what they called a threshing floor. A threshing floor was a large area that was out in the open. And the big thing you want to do on a threshing floor is you want to separate the wheat from the chaff. And so in this big area, you put all your wheat out and you try to throw it up in the air so that the wind will come along and it'll start to separate the wheat from the chaff. So you want to be out in the open. But Gideon is threshing wheat in a wine press. Now, a wine press is a very small hole in the ground, barely big enough for you to turn around in. It's below ground, so there's not much room to operate. There's not much room to put your wheat in, so you can't work very efficiently, and it's below ground, so you don't have the wind that comes along to help to separate the wheat from the chaff. So why is Gideon threshing wheat in a wine press? He wants to keep his wheat. He's afraid that the Midianites are going to see his wheat and they're going to come and take it, because that's what they've been doing to everybody. They've ravaged the land. They're taking all the food. They're taking everything. So here's Gideon in fear trying to thresh wheat in a wine press to keep from starving to death. Scared to death. Now, you need to understand something about Gideon. Gideon was not a mighty warrior. He was not a man of valor. When you think of Gideon, if the image that comes to mind is, say, Chuck Norris or someone like that, that's the wrong image to have when you think of Gideon. Gideon wasn't the Terminator. Okay, nobody was afraid of Gideon. When you think of Gideon, it's probably more helpful to think of Pee-wee Herman. That's my generation. For those of you who are younger than me, if you think of Fred on Nickelodeon, you know what I'm talking about, kids? What's his name? Fred, I had to write it down here. Fred Figglehorn on Nickelodeon, okay? Not what you would call a tough guy. Not someone you'd be afraid of. That's Gideon. But God calls out to Gideon. He calls to him. He comes where he's threshing wheat in a wine press. And he calls to Gideon and he says, Gideon, I have a job for you to do. Verse 12 of Judges 6, it says, when the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, the Lord is with you, mighty warrior. But sir, Gideon replied, if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian. Can you appreciate Gideon's response here? He says, you know, the promise has come down through our fathers, through the generations, that this would be a land of milk and honey, a land of plenty. And we don't see that promise coming to pass at all. We are oppressed. We are in trouble. Things are going bad. And so, God, where are you? And this is what people of faith often think when things go bad. I mean, you can't help but say, where's God in the midst of this trouble, in the midst of this terrible situation that I'm in? Because it really feels in that moment that God has abandoned you, that he's run off somewhere else to take care of business somewhere else. And then if you're a person of faith, you feel guilty for not having enough faith, which is a real catch-22, because God's abandoned you and now you feel guilty for feeling like God's abandoned you. But here's what I want you to notice. God does not get angry at Gideon at this point for asking this question, God, where are you? It doesn't seem like you're anywhere here to help us. God does not chastise Gideon for his lack of faith. In fact, God says to him in verse 14, he says, the Lord turned to him and said, go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? And Gideon replies in verse 15, but Lord, Gideon asked, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family. Now, how would you assess Gideon's self-confidence at this point? Pretty low. He says, God, you've got to be kidding me. You're sending me to fight the Midianites? Do you not understand that God, don't you understand where I'm coming from? He says, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I'm the least in my family. In other words, I'm the least of the least. My family is the least, and in my family, I'm the least of the least. What in the world do you have in store for me to do for you against this huge nation of Midian? Nevertheless, God replies in verse 16. He says, I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together. And this is the hinge on which this story turns right here. Because what God is saying, he says, Gideon, I know you're the least of the least. I know that in your family, you're the lowest of the lowest. And I know your family's the lowest of the lowest. But it's not about that. He doesn't say to Gideon, Gideon, I'm gonna pep you up here because you need to know that because of your great wisdom and your great intellect and your great fortitude and your great good looks, that is gonna save the day for the Israelites. He doesn't give them a self-confidence speech. All he says is, go and I will be with you. It's not about your power. It's not about your strength. It's not about your confidence. It's not about your standing in the family. It's really not about you at all, Gideon. I'm going to do it through you, but it's not about you. And what's true for Gideon is always true for us. Whenever God calls us to something big, he doesn't call us because we're naturally equipped to do the job. He calls us to do his job, but he says, I will be your strength. I will be there with you. I will accomplish it through you. What is unthinkable on your own is possible with God. What is impossible for you alone, I can do through you. And so God instructs Gideon on how he's going to overthrow the Midianites. And he begins by telling Gideon to go and tear down an altar to the local god Baal. Now, Baal was a god that was worshipped by the Midianites, very, very well-known god in that time, in that part of the world. Among other things, Baal was the god of crops, the god of abundance, the god of fertility, the god who makes things grow. So, being an agricultural society, it was important that Baal was on your side, because if your crops were going to grow and if you were going to have lots of children, have a big family, you would worship Baal. And the way they worshiped Baal was through cultic prostitution and even child sacrifice. Certainly by our standards, a very cruel and immoral type of religion. But Baal was the god of the day. And God goes to Gideon and he says, Gideon, I want you to tear down an altar to Baal. But not just any altar to Baal, I want you to tear down a specific altar to Baal. And it's not an altar that was built by the Midianites, but one that was built by the Israelites, and not just any Israelite, but Gideon's own father. Gideon's dad had built an altar to Baal. The family worshiped Baal. And what God says is, Gideon, I want you to stand up to your dad. I want you to go tear down the family altar to Baal. Now, how many times do you think Gideon had stood up to his dad? Verse 15, Gideon said, I'm the least in my family. He probably never stood up to his dad. He was at the bottom of the family organizational chart. He had never stood up to his dad before. Nevertheless, Gideon obeys God. And it says in verse 27 of Judges 6, verse 27 says, so Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as the Lord told him. But because he was afraid of his family and the men of the town, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. So Gideon takes 10 of his servants and they go, but they're so afraid of what's going to happen if they get seen that they do this at night. So they go and they tear down the altar of Baal and they replace it with an altar to God. But unfortunately for Gideon, he gets caught, because the next day, everyone sees that the altar to Baal is gone. It's been replaced by an altar to God, and the people of the town are furious. Baal's going to be mad at us. Our crops aren't going to grow. We're not going to have children. This is a catastrophe. We've got to find who's done this. And they call for an execution of whoever it is who's knocked down this altar to Baal. And so they conduct an investigation, and sure enough, they find that Gideon is the one who tore down his father's altar to Baal. And they call for Gideon's execution. And Gideon's dad steps up. He comes to the men of the town, and he says a very interesting thing. He says to the men of the town, he says, if Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar. This is verse 31. Gideon's dad said to these guys, hey, Baal's a great big god, right? He can stand up for himself. We don't have to execute vengeance. Let Baal execute vengeance. Very clever trick on Gideon's father's part. And it ends up working. The men of the town say, you're right. Baal's a big god. He can take care of himself. We'll let him handle it. And so Gideon's life at that point is spared. And so now it's time for Gideon to actually assemble his army and go up and fight the Midianites and free the people of Israel. But Gideon is still so scared that he decides to make a deal with God. He wants to make sure God is really serious about this. And this is probably the most well-known part of the Gideon story, verses 36 and 37. Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. And if there was dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said. So Gideon comes up with a test. He says, God, I'm going to put a piece of wool, a fleece of wool on the ground here on the threshing floor. And if in the morning, if the fleece of wool is wet, but the ground all around it is dry, I'll know that you're with me and I'll know that you want me to go fight the Midianites. So the next morning, Gideon gets up. He goes out and inspects, and sure enough, it's all dry around the fleece, but he picks up the fleece. It's sopping wet. It says in the Bible, he wrung out an entire bowl full of water out of that fleece. It was so wet. But Gideon's still not convinced. Well, what if it's just, maybe it rained overnight and the ground already dry, but the fleece hung onto the water? So he says, God, I just want to make sure. I'm going to do one more test with you. We're going to reverse it. This time, make the ground wet, but the fleece dry. If the ground is wet and the fleece is dry, then I'll know that you're with me. So the next morning he gets up. Sure enough, ground is wet, fleece is dry. Gideon can't test God anymore. Okay, it's time to go to battle, time to assemble the army. Let's do it. And so Gideon sends out a message to all the nearby tribes in Israel to join him for battle to go up against the Midianites. And he assembles a big army, 32,000 soldiers. Big army. Only problem is, compared to the Midianites, it was a small army. The Midianites had 135,000 soldiers. The Midianites outnumber the Israelites 4-1. Now, if you're going into battle, hand-to-hand combat, and you're outnumbered 4-1, what would you do? You wouldn't go into battle, right? And Gideon says, look, God, you called me to do this job, but I have a numbers problem on my hand. I only have 32,000 soldiers. They have 135. I need more soldiers. And God says, yeah, Gideon, you do have a numbers problem. Gideon says, oh, good, God, I'm glad you understand. And God says, Gideon, here's what you're going to do. You need fewer soldiers. So here's what I want you to do, Gideon. I want you to send home all your soldiers who are afraid. Gideon's like, oh, good, that would be me, right? Everyone except you, Gideon, who's afraid, you send them home. And so two-thirds of Gideon's army, they have a morale problem. They all go home. 22,000 of the soldiers go home. Two-thirds of the army. He's left with 10,000 soldiers. They went from a 4-to-1 ratio, now it's they're outnumbered 13-to-1. And now God really starts to mess with Gideon's head, because God comes to Gideon again and says, Gideon, I see that you have a numbers problem. And Gideon says, God, I don't need your help with the numbers anymore, okay? And God says, no, I want to go one more round with you, Gideon. And God comes to him and he says in Judges 7:5, he says, so Gideon took the men down to the water. And there the Lord told him, separate those who lap the water with their tongues like a dog from those who kneel down to drink. God says, I want you to separate your army one more time. I want you to get rid of some more men. Here's how you're going to know who to get rid of. Send them all, they're all thirsty, send them down to the river to get a drink, and watch how they drink water. Some of them are going to put their face right down into the stream and they're going to drink. Others are going to scoop up water into their hands and they're going to lap it like a dog. All the ones who put their face in the stream, Gideon, send them home. I only want you to keep the ones who lap water like a dog. Now, why did God tell Gideon to keep the ones who lapped water like a dog? You know, when I always heard this story growing up, I was always told that it was because the ones who scooped the water up in their hands and lapped it like a dog, they were more attentive to the enemy. They didn't put their face down in the water. They kept their face upright so they could see if the enemy was coming. Here's the problem with that theory. In the Bible, it is never good to be compared to a dog. It is always derogatory in the Bible to be compared to a dog in any way, shape, or form. People in that day look at dogs very differently than we look at dogs today. Today, we love our dogs. We call our dogs part of the family. If our dogs get injured, we send them for surgery. It ends up costing more for the pet to have surgery than for us to have surgery. We'll do anything for our dogs, right? Not in that day. To be considered a dog or in any way compared to a dog was derogatory. It was negative. And so there's an Old Testament scholar by the name of Doug Stewart. He says this. He says, the idea most likely is that the guys who lapped water like a dog drank in a way that we would think of as geeky or nerdy. In other words, God said, Gideon, I want you to separate your army, and I just want you to take the geeks and the nerds, and they're going to be the ones who you're going to fight with. The ones who don't even know how to drink water like a normal person, they're your guys. Okay? These are not the Navy SEALs. These are not the elite of the elite. These are the geeks and the nerds. And God says, these are my men. And so God leaves Gideon with 300 nerds to fight the Midianites. Okay, 300 Pee Wee Hermans. I mean, 300 guys who can't even carry a sword hardly. They have no idea how to fight. They are now outnumbered at this point by the Midianites, 450 to 1. Started off 4-to-1, now it's 450-to-1. And none of them are soldiers. Now God is winnowing Gideon's troops for a reason. It's because when the battle comes, he wants there to be no doubt how this battle was won, how the Israelites were victorious, because it will not be by their own strength that they win the battle. God will make them victorious over the Midianites, but it will be God and God alone who will do the work. And God is doing this because he wants to break the cycle that Israel is in. That every time they get scared, every time they get afraid, they go and they stop worshiping the big God of Israel, and they find one of the local deities and they start worshiping a false god. And they get into this cycle over and over, and God is determined to break the cycle once and for all. He's going to say, look, I'm going to show you who the big God is around here. And it's not Baal. It's me. So stop trusting in the little deities and put all your trust in me. And what happens next is truly miraculous, because Gideon and his men, they make a surprise attack on the Midianites, but not one man in the Israelite army is carrying a sword. All they have is a torch and a ram's horn. He sends the entire 300 army into battle with no weapons, no swords, but each man has a torch and a ram's horn. And as they come down the mountain, at night they have their torches lit and they're blowing on their ram's horns. The Midianites go into panic mode. And they start fighting each other and they start killing each other. And the ones who don't get killed, they flee. And the Israelites win the battle without even having to do a thing besides blow on a ram's horn and hold up a torch. Not one Israelite is injured or killed. And the Midianites are completely decimated. And now the Israelites know who the real God is. The real God is so much bigger than even their worst circumstances. The real God is so much bigger than being outnumbered 450-1. Their God is bigger than the biggest Midianite army that they can face. Their God is bigger than any of their biggest fears. And all this to show that God never intended for his people to have to live by their own strength, but to live in confidence and trust in him and to allow him to fight the battles for them. Now, the world that we live in today is very different than the world that they lived in ancient times, right? And a question that we always have to ask and that we always struggle with is, how is the Bible from thousands of years ago relevant to today? How is a story about Gideon relevant to today? Because today is so different than yesterday. I mean, things are, you know, culture and education and science and medicine and technology, all these things are, we're so advanced beyond where they were. That how is this stuff relevant? I mean, things have changed so much. But there are two things that haven't changed in all these thousands of years. One of them is God. And the other is human nature. Those two things remain the same. And one of the constants about human nature that has not changed and was just as true in Gideon's day and is true in our day is we're very prone to fear. And when we get afraid, we have two basic human responses: fight or flight, right? Fight or flight. And just as we get afraid today, the people in Bible times got just as afraid then. In fact, all the heroes, all the giants of the Bible, they were all people who faced fear like we do. I mean, it wasn't just Gideon who was afraid. Abraham was afraid. Moses was afraid. Joshua was afraid. David was afraid. Elijah was afraid. Peter, James, John, really all of Jesus' disciples, they were all fraidy cats. They all dealt with fear, just like we do. And that is why, and I know we've mentioned this before, that is why the most common command in the Bible is do not fear. And the reason most often given for why we should not fear is because God says, "For I am with you." Amen. Because I'm a big God, and I've got your back. So fear is universal. It is part of human nature. And another thing about fear is that fear is always linked to false gods. Anytime we become afraid, anytime we become fearful, we all have just an innate instinct to find a false god to put our trust in, to save us from whatever it is that we're afraid of. And we very easily get into this cycle. We get afraid, and so we turn to a false god. And we turn to a false god, and instead of getting rid of our fears, it actually makes us more afraid. And we get afraid, and we turn to our false gods again, but it doesn't help our fear, and so our fear gets worse, and we get into this cycle. And we're not even aware that we're doing it. But fear is always linked to false gods. There's a guy by the name of Justin Buzzard. How'd you like to be named Justin Buzzard? But he writes about this link between fear and false gods. He says, in our day, you know, we're not tempted to worship the false gods of Baal or Asherah. Our false gods are spiritual. They're unseen. But they are as real as the false gods of Israel's day. He says there are four false gods that we're all tempted to worship. He says they are control, approval, comfort, and power. And when we get afraid, all of us have one of these four false gods that we just instinctually turn to try to allay our fears. And he says, that which you fear the most will reveal your false god. So for example, he says, he gives a little assessment on how you can determine what your instinctual false god is. He said, some people's instinctual false god is control. And he says, you know you have a control idol if your greatest fear, your greatest nightmare is uncertainty. If what keeps you up at night is fear about what might be coming down the road, all the potential bad things that might happen, if that's what keeps you up at night, the false god that you're going to turn to control your fear is control. You're going to try to control your circumstances. You're going to try to control the people around you to allay your fears about uncertainty. But all it's going to do is make you even more fearful about the uncertainty of life. And you're going to get into that spin. Others of us, our false god is approval. He says, you know you have an approval idol if your greatest fear, your greatest nightmare is rejection. If nothing would wreck your world more than to be rejected by people you care about, to be rejected by people close to you, if that's your greatest fear, then the false god you're always going to chase is approval, in hopes that by winning people's approval, it'll take away your fear. But in fact, it enhances the fear. Another false god is comfort. He says, you know you have a comfort idol if your greatest fear, your greatest nightmare is stress or demands. If the worst thing possible for you is just a difficult life, a painful life, a life of stress and demands placed on you, you're going to turn to comfort to try to get away from all that. And finally, he says there's power. He says, you know you have a power idol if your greatest fear, your greatest nightmare is humiliation or embarrassment. We all have things we're afraid of, and we all have false gods we turn to in those moments. And God says, just like he said to the Israelites a long time ago, he says, I want to break that cycle of you turning to the false gods to try to allay your fears, because it never works. God wants to set each one of you free from whatever false idol it is that your heart instinctually turns to. Not just because he's a jealous God, but because he cares about you. And he knows that the more you worship false gods, whether it be fear, approval, control, power, whatever it is, the more enslaved you will be. And his will is not for you to be enslaved, but for you to be free. God's desire is for us to live in power and in freedom. And you'll never get there by trying harder not to be afraid. Willpower alone will not get you past your fears. It comes by putting your trust in a different God, a God who really is big enough to handle your fears. And I don't know about you, but I face fears all the time. All the time. I'm constantly on the verge of feeling overwhelmed by stuff I'm facing, whether it's stuff here at the church, stuff at home, stuff in my relationships. All these things that feel so much bigger than me and that I feel like I have no control of, but if they get out of control, my life is going to be a mess. I'm constantly facing those fears. And it's in those moments that my inner Gideon kicks in and says, there is no way that I can deal with this. So I need more power. I need more control. I need more something. And the good part is that as I continue to grow and mature and to walk in Jesus, there's another voice that's getting louder. I mean, the one that says, get power, get control, get comfort, it's still loud, but there's another one that's gaining in volume. And it says, Dennis, there's a reason that you feel this way. There's a reason that you're afraid. And the reason you feel this way is because it's not up to you to have all the answers. It's not up to you to take control. It's not up to you to fix everything, to figure it all out. It says, Dennis, you're not alone in this. I'm here with you. I'm going to face this with you. I'll be here with you. And this is the part I really don't like. He says, I'm not going to tell you what the outcome of this situation is going to be, because that's what I want to know. Just tell me how it's going to end. But the voice says, I'm not going to tell you how it's going to end. I'm just going to tell you it's going to be okay. But you got to trust me on that and keep walking with me. And don't turn to a false god. And that's the walk of faith. And the thing is that as faith grows, the result of that is not the elimination of problems. I think sometimes you have this idea that once I get to a certain point in my faith journey, I won't have any more problems. No, faith does not eliminate problems. But faith is the inner reality that God is big enough to handle whatever my problems are. There's nothing too big for him. Faith is Paul sitting in a prison cell saying, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That's faith. Faith is Gideon going into battle with 300 geeks. That's faith. And see, nobody and no thing can give you this inner reality of faith. No education, no degree, no amount of experience, no circumstances can give this to you. It is simply between you and God. And God knows all about the Midianites in your life right now. God knows all about your worries. He knows all about your anxieties. He knows all about your kids and how scared you are about their future and all the things they face and all the bad roads they might take. He knows all about your crumbling marriage. He knows all about your divorce. He knows how lonely you feel. He knows how frustrated you are because the dreams that you have either been shattered or it seems like they've just been put on hold. He knows about your job failure. He knows about your failing health. And he knows that you are so tempted to try to reach for a false god right now to help you out in your situation. And what he wants you to know is what he wanted Gideon to know is that he's bigger than all those things. And he wants to fight the battle for you, not you fight it on your own. There's nothing about your situation right now that leaves him puzzled or confused. There's nothing about what you're facing right now that has caught him off guard saying, wow, I didn't see this coming in that person's life. I don't know what to do now. I guess they're on their own. No, our God is big enough. He was big enough for Gideon when he faced the Midianites, and he's big enough for you in whatever the Midianites are that you're going to face this coming week.